Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our conversations about the cultures of conversation and consciousness. I was listening to the NPR station the other day in the car. Like a lot of people, I listen to the news in the car, and I often find myself sort of going with my demographic groove and listening to NPR. And, you know, I find it annoying in a lot of ways, but it's a decent source of information. And our local Pacifica station can get a bit ranty at points. So, you know, I accept the mixture of decent and slightly annoying. And then they had a little news item about the recent Molly deaths in the East Coast, kids who had been partying on what they believed to have been ecstasy and subsequently dying. And the NPR reporter was so atrociously misinformed about what Molly is, how long it's been around, what MDMA is, how to talk about drug deaths, how to think about the existence of psychoactives, unregulated psychoactives in a youth culture, that basically the entire slant language and a level of disinformation of the spot was entirely from the sort of DEA information lords who were copiously quoted throughout the talk. And, I mean, I was just livid. I was sent into one of those apoplectic news rages. And it reminded me, in retrospect, just how terribly poor the information about psychoactives remains in our society, despite the fact that they are so not going away, and in fact are actually increasing, both legal and scheduled psychoactives are surging through our lives, our minds, the lives and minds of children, of young people, of older people, and that our society remains criminally incoherent about engaging the realities, the facts of these substances, let alone developing a sane, balanced, healthy and realistic assessment of the role of these things in our lives. So it made me once again incredibly appreciative of the internet, which sometimes drives me nuts, but has been a boon in many ways to the reliable information about psychoactives, because this is the kind of information the government doesn't necessarily want you to know, so they're not going to let you know so much, and otherwise it's scattered about in all sorts of obscure scientific, sociological bits, and a lot of incoherent lore from your, you know, brother's sister's cousin, and et cetera, et cetera. And the internet has really allowed for the creation of a much more robust, intelligent, and informed dialogue about psychoactives. It has had other effects as well, some of which are a bit more disturbing, and which we may talk about later this hour with our guests, Earth and Fire, who run Arrowood.com and the Arrowood Center. And Arrowood.com, as I'm sure many of the listeners know, is the preeminent source for rational, sane, fascinating, and overwhelming information about current psychoactive use. It's essentially an encyclopedia or library of information about psychoactive, scientific information, but also information from users, experience reports, a tremendous amount of historical research material, and just in general, the one-stop shop for people interested in psychoactives, which of course include people who are for whom it's they're important parts of their lives. So it has serves a really great, you know, harm reduction role of letting people find out what actually is going on with the substances they might be floating around their college dorm rooms. But it's also an important source for all sorts of toxicologists and lawyers and parents and policemen. And it's a really extraordinary resource, and extraordinary even more because it's the kind of thing that the government should be doing in some sense, or an enlightened form of the government. And if not the government, then at least a well-established, well-funded institution with, you know, up on the hill somewhere with glassy doors and lots of docs walking around and people doing research and sociologists, et cetera, but it's basically done by these two characters, Earth and Fire, and a small troop of devoted helpers and workers who keep this remarkable resource alive. So I'm very happy here at the, we're getting towards the end of their September fund drive. Every September they ask users to chip in mostly pretty small amounts, but they all add up because they have so many people coming to their site. And here we, as we're winding up the September run, I convinced them to come on to the show. So I'm really, really excited to have them on and to talk about where things are at, both with their new Arrowhead Center and also just what's going on with the world of drugs and the internet and new compounds, and it's just it's a crazy world out there. But before we bring them on, our co-host here, Maja Daou. Maja, who, as you may remember, has been a professional librarian, and so I think has a particular interest and positive feelings about the Arrowhead site because it is such a remarkable library, among other things. So how you doing, Maja?
I'm doing good, Eric. Yeah, it's funny because I love the Arrowhead site, even if you disregard the contents of it completely, that it's about, you know, drugs, as some people would say. But the fact of its depth of a collection of information and data based on experience and, empirical data is a total accomplishment. And funny about the library, like when I was a kid, at 15, 14, finding out that other kids were doing drugs, I was like, well, even before I did any drugs, I hate the word drugs, I wish it was a better word, but I had to go to the library and try to find books so I could get an idea, like, what do these drugs do? Like, what happens to you? Because you think, like, oh, I'll take LSD. Well, at that, if you have no access to any information, you have no clue what's going to happen to your brain when you take it. Like, there's nothing that, you know, you'll have, like, the fat kid on the block will tell you, like, oh, this is what will happen. But there's no, like, good source of information that will tell you the effects of even, like, prescription drugs. Like, you can get the list of side effects, but there's nowhere you could even look up, say, Tylenol and look at what effects will this have on you that's readily available. So the fact that, you know, Arrowhead exists that has these explanations on it, to me, is culturally, even for people that, like you said, for doctors, for lawyers, for, you know, for press people, it is an invaluable resource, invaluable.
There we go. Let's bring on Earth and Fire. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi.
I know it's a little early for you. Thanks for dragging yourselves out and joining us on the on the phone line. You know, I think that though it's sort of predictable, I would like to ask you about the origins of the site. I mean, it's been such a lifelong project for you guys, a labor of love, but it emerged out of a really specific time and place, both in terms of the internet and in terms of the kind of transformations in psychoactive culture, and I just love to hear a little bit about what got you going on this thing that took over your lives.
Well, I guess I would say that in a very similar story, Earth and I went to the same college, and when we were in school, there were a lot of people around us who were doing a variety of different psychoactive drugs, and the people that they went to for information were the people that were 2 years older than them, who clearly didn't know very much more about them than they did. And so, you know, we were confronted with the question of whether we were going to try something, and we turned out that we're both the sort of people who would like to research that question a lot before making any sort of decision, and it was really hard. I mean, you know, in our experience, when we went to the library, college library, you know, you could find a Timothy Leary book, and I think in our library there was From Chocolate to Morphine. I think that was one of the other books by Andrew Weil. But really very little information. Your other option was to order a book through interlibrary loan, which we debated for a while. It's like, do you really want to write down on your school paper, you know, documentation?
That's what I did.
Yeah, exactly. with the library, Mrs. Whoever, which, you know, that you'd like the books, you know, clearly all on the topic of drugs. It's like, well, I don't know whether I'd like to do that or not. And so, you know, we both graduated, and then we ended up moving to California, and I guess that was in 1994. So the internet and websites were just starting to be really, you know, clearly the direction of the future. And I needed a job. I had no job since I had just graduated from college. And so the quick and easy thing to do was to learn HTML and try and get myself a job doing web design. And as I was learning, practicing building web pages, I needed practice data. I needed something to put together to practice making web pages that linked to each other from, you know, just the very basics of web design.
So we collected a wide variety of books and papers and stuff from Usenet and email lists that we were on, and Fire collected that into the first version of the Arrowwood website. And we came up with the name in early 95 and then kind of publicly launched the website in October of 1995.
At that point in time, we didn't really intend to make a website. But as soon as we had something that vaguely could be called a website, people would ask questions on an email list we were on, for example, and the answer would be one of the papers that I had put up on the site, and so I would point them to it, and very quickly it just became clear that it was something that was supposed to happen, needed to happen, so we kept going.
Well, I mean, that's one of the interesting things about the site and the history of it and the story and the role that it plays is how it's absolutely woven into the unique conditions of the internet, and particularly the World Wide Web. Psychoactives are so much about information. I remember Terrence McKenna saying this at one point. I went, "What do you mean by that?" I mean, and he's saying, "Well, it's all about like what you know and who you know and what you know about who you know and where the information comes from." It has this kind of, on the one hand, there's all of the scientific information of varying qualities, and then there's all this lore, you know, the older cousins, 2 years older kind of stuff. And then there's all these books, but they're kind of hard to find, and you feel sort of unnerved seeking them out or using interlibrary loan. So it's like there's already this whole, like, weird culture of information before the internet surrounding drugs. And then once that information found, you know, the internet through you and, you know, some other people, but, you know, you wound up carrying the torch, it's like it was just going to surge through and find its new home, which has just completely changed the discourse on drugs. And I'd love to hear you reflect a little bit, you know, as in, you know, people who work with technology, who understand the internet, who spend a tremendous amount of time on the internet for the course of its sort of modern life as a popular medium. How would you characterize the way in which the environment, the discourse around drugs, the way people think about them, the way they factor in their lives, has changed because of the internet?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Okay, so,
well, let me start,
yeah, go
back
ahead
a little bit. That one thing I want to say is that we're part of a larger group of people who are kind of the drug geeks who do spend a lot of time updating, maintaining, and collecting information about psychoactive drugs. And Arrowhead didn't come out of nothing. There were a number of other people who were doing similar types of things at the time, and most of them very sanely stopped. As it turns out, it's not very profitable to give away information for free, especially about topics that are so controversial. So there's a Usenet was a big place where there was a lot of discussions, and Usenet is kind of dead now. It is still functional, but it was sort of a news / email list forum system before the web. And now the thing that jumps to mind when you ask the question is I don't really have an answer to it, but is that there are so many people now who have grown up who came of age, sort of, let's call it after, you know, sort of 1999 and after, where who just have a deep level expectation, absolute base level expectation, that they will be able to find the information on the internet if they go look for it. And so that is a total change from my experience as a teen to a college student, where when we went looking for information about whatever,
anything really.
I was offered something called Adam in 1987, and I was given a brief description of what that was, and I learned that later was MDMA, and then Adam, the name kind of dropped off and isn't really used anymore, kind of like a Molly name. And I found very little, you know, like sort of risks, that kind of stuff. There was really almost nothing, and now there is an overwhelming amount of information about MDMA or ecstasy, and that's one of the things that really surprises me, is that it seems to me like the reporters who write about these things are sort of the least informed people. I do most of the management of the ecstasy data site, which is a street drug testing project where people can send in their samples anonymously to the lab and have them tested. And so we got a bunch of contacts a couple weeks ago when there was a couple of deaths and a bunch of hospitalizations around, quote, Molly. And the reporters I talked to, it was difficult. It's difficult to start someone out who knows approximately nothing about the topic area and work them all the way up through what Molly means in modern society, right? And it was weird how many of the stories couldn't even get the basics right. And so,
like Eric, I think, said in his initial introduction, the idea of reporters not being able to get the basic concepts of there's a drug, it has a chemical name by which you could identify it positively, and then there's a lot of slang names which might mean it, might mean something else, you know, just that sort of nuance. I'm so surprised by how frequently they get that wrong. But I wanted to back up a little bit to Eric's actual question and say that one of the things I would differentiate between in terms of the impact of what the impact is of information about psychoactives online is that the thing that we try to do is to make it organized and orderly so that you could find the piece of information you're looking for, not just a lot of information. The internet as a whole has a lot of information about psychoactives. I kind of think about the unorganized masses of data that are online like the sorts of data that were available from the two-year-old or college students that you knew when you were in college. Like, it's out there, it's near you, but how do you find it, right? And so, for me, organization is the key. And I think that one of the impacts that having access to better organized or well-organized, at least basic data about various psychoactive drugs, is that there will be a lot more of the people who will choose to experiment will have a basic understanding of what the effects they're going to get, how much they should be taking, and you know that they have the right expectations and a vague sense of intentionality behind it by being able to study the substance a little bit before going into the experience. Now, a lot of people still don't do that, so it's interesting that we actually get some people who tell us they don't want to know anything about a drug before they try it. It's totally not how my brain works, but it has always struck me. I keep trying to remember
One. Is it because they feel like their experience is going to be impacted by having somebody else's experience as a model in their head, or are they more like risk takers?
I think it's definitely like they want to just experience the peer experience without being somehow swayed by having read about it.
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. I mean, that's one thing that you must have thought about, as especially, you know, one of the many remarkable resources on Arrowood are these experience reports, which are valuable on so many different levels. I mean, even in just the work alone that you do in filtering out, you know, unpublishable ones and ones that are pranks and ones that are just full of just absurdity, and even include, and then going through and having to point out points, which you do with great care, where people make certain decisions that are not recommended, and you're very
right.
Clear about, you know, this isn't really necessarily a good decision to make, but you're still going to put up some of that information because it's incredibly valuable. It's how other people get a sense of, is this something that I would ever want to do? And in the meantime, you're creating this great, you know, kind of anthropological sort of database of information. But one of the things that you see there is how ideas about what drugs mean, including even the names of them, sort of reverberate through people's experiences. And it's
right.
A very interesting thing, and this is one of the questions I've always had and we've talked about before, is that how do you think about the way in which, even if you're trying to be just pure objective librarians who are creating some kind of order to a very disordered range of information that people are going to go for anyway, but you are creating a more accessible, more intelligent, more efficient way of distributing information. And obviously, now that Arrowood is so popular, I mean, I don't remember the numbers, you can quote them if you want, but it's so widely used across the world. So many people turn to it, especially younger people who are exploring these things, but lots of other folks as well, and, you know, saves lives, makes decisions, you know, helps people make decisions, et cetera, et cetera. You're so much a part of this process whereby people decide what drugs mean, which ones are good, how do you take them, what do you think about them. How do you think about that role or that responsibility? I mean, it must be kind of heavy in some ways, or it's fraught. And I'm really curious as you've come to realize that you play a significant role in the overall ecology, how you think about that role.
Well, it's true. Certainly, it's something we think about a lot.
So, for the kind of one of our first principles is try to not have worse information than is out there otherwise, right? So, yes, it's the kind of the moral and philosophical questions of kind of how we fit into the world and how we affect the culture and decision making of other people, but one of the impetuses for us to continue, so after we put up the first site in 95 and it was very small, you know, in kind of 97, 98, as we were kind of wrestling with some of those questions as the site gained traffic, was that some of the sites we were like not exactly competing with, but we were kind of working, we were similar to, had horrifyingly inaccurate information. And they weren't in library format. They weren't collectors. They were just kind of presenting information. And the information.
And so at that level, there's a certain comfort. That not a lot of controversy on our end about how we feel about what we're doing. If what we're doing is just making it so that the people who look up information about MDMA find something that's accurate as opposed to something that's really inaccurate, because they're going to find something. It's not like they're going to find Arrowood or nothing. They're going to find Arrowood or whatever else, you know, is available.
A GeoCities site.
Exactly, and that's an interesting thing, because then it forces us to look at the way in which prohibition is not just about, you know, enforcement on the level of substance and distribution networks and manufacturers and dealers and all that. The prohibition is also an information strategy, or rather a, you know, anti-information or actively disinformation strategy. So in a way, you get involved in the kind of information level of the enforcement regime, because some people will say, yeah, that's fine, but you're just making it easier for kids to find out how to do these things and blah, blah, blah. And so in a way, Which is like, okay, you can understand why some upset parent would take that perspective in a limited way, but they're not looking at the larger ecology. And the way I always think about it is you're really, in the end, the site is driven by this philosophy about information and people's rights to make choices with the best information they have. And that's ultimately a scientific perspective. It's like, look, we bring as much data as we can. The world's a confusing place. We'll make it available. So it strikes me that there's a very hopeful kind of underpinning to the ideas about information, the ideas about bringing people's experiences and as much data as you can and organizing it, because you're really hoping that people can make better decisions with better information.
Well, one of the things that we actually say to ourselves often is that it sometimes feels like we're in historically in a little zone where information about anything, really, let alone about psychoactives, but the populace now has access at their fingertips to information to a degree that has never been true before. And they're not really very good at using it, right? That in just that way, like what we don't really know what effect that has on people on the world. And I think it's going to take a little while before it kind of all settles out and we figure out how that happens. I think we're sort of in this position where we've taken a bunch of people who aren't ready to have every bit of information historically, you know, at their fingertips and given it all to them. And we're seeing what happens. You have to go through this period. I mean, it has to happen. It's going to happen. It is happening.
we were having that same conversation with Mark Pesce, a futurist who has moved to Australia, and I was ranting about sort of the issues of sort of like what the hell humans are like when they have ubiquitous, you know, constant access to the entire information stream, and his opinion was that basically we're talking about a different species. You know, it's not that they can't interbreed with the ones that don't have ubiquitous access, but that really humans are just a fundamentally different thing once we are fully immersed in that state. And seeing past what that means is very hard. But you know, our view is definitely, like, it was a little bit of a cop-out what I was saying with sort of, you know, the earlier statement I made in response to your question, saying that we were doing it to try to improve the information, because we do consider it at sort of a deep philosophical level, and we thought about it from the start, and it's our view that there needs to be a process of evolution towards more and better information, and that the distinction between the legal distinction and the social distinctions between the different psychoactive drugs that are available are largely arbitrary, so that we have, you know, industries that have billions of dollars and are allowed to sell all of the drugs that they want and advertise them during NFL football games. And then there is the industry that has billions of dollars and develops their drugs and is not allowed to advertise their drugs during NFL football games. And some of the distinctions are rational, and many of them are not. And that we are in a world where a huge portion of the population has access to or will be confronted with a decision about whether to take illegal psychoactive drugs or legal psychoactive drugs. We consider caffeine to be a psychoactive drug, and this is a slightly weird debate for people who accept that caffeine is a psychoactive drug. It's very obvious, and for people who don't, it seems like we're trying to include their
ice cream
in with LSD and heroin. And the point that we try to make by including caffeine is that people behave differently when they have caffeine. People are more talkative if they're on high dose caffeine. People are more willing to sit at their desk jobs if they have caffeine. And it's a shift in the culture. It's just important that people realize that there are all of these choices about the ways that we alter our mind states. And the future looks like it's just a lot more complicated. You know, where technologies, brain technologies, and the easier manufacture of new and crazier drugs.
Well, you've just opened up a whole bunch of fascinating questions, but we're going to take a break before we come back and go into some of them. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Majid Daou. We're talking with Earth and Fire from Airwood.com and the Airwood Center. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Majid Daou. We're here with Eric Davis, and we're speaking with Earth and Fire from the Airwood website, which for those of you that may have never gone on there, we highly suggest it. Just spend a little while, maybe an hour or two on the website, thinking around and look at what they've amassed on there. And before the break, you brought up so many good points. And I mean, in my mind, I feel like you said, like with all this, there's all this information out there, right? People have access to it all of a sudden. And the importance becomes about the curation and who are the
right
minds and who's discerning and who's kind of like putting it together, which obviously, sadly, the journalists aren't doing. So we're getting like people are just confronted with tons of information all the time. And it's more and more rare that it's getting fact-checked, you know, or people that have any kind of authority. Because the problem with the Internet, of course, everyone can put stuff up, right? You can have any idiot, so to speak, 12-year-old at home on their computer, and they can post stuff on a blog, and then someone will repost, and then all of a sudden everybody has that wrong piece of information. It's like a huge broken telephone machine that we've made. So, but on Airwood, I wanted to ask you guys, like, how do you guys manage the curation of it? Like, for example, when people give you their experiences or kind of give a contribution, what do you guys use to help you discern, like, what makes the cut and what doesn't? Like, do you guys just research every single edition that gets on? Or what's the kind of, like, delineating factor for the cutoff?
Well, so I would say that there's experience reports have their own system. So the answer is a little bit different for experience reports versus pretty much any other type of data. For experience reports, we have a robust software system that Earth designed that we have a lot of volunteers who have all been trained at a very basic level. And as an experience report comes in, well, it sits in a big pile for a really long time, and eventually someone gets around to reading it because there's a lot of submissions. but then what happens first is a triager, we call them, that's the lowest level of volunteer working on experience reports, reads it and gives it a grade. They rate it. And then a second triager does the same thing.
They can mark them for administrative attention in case there's some specialized reason, like a recent hospitalization or a death or something like that.
But pretty much their job is just to rate it. And then another a second triager does the same thing. So we get two independent, basically A to F ratings of a report. And then a next level up trained person.
Once they're at least double triaged, they go into a different list. So then
the reviewers, that's the next level up, can look at all of the reports that have been double triaged. So they generally pick from higher quality rather than picking from lower quality. So that they don't even read Fs. They just start out at the A's. There aren't very many of. And then their job is to go through, edit it when necessary. We try not to do too much editing on experience reports because writing style and level of education and level of you know, a lot of things come through in an author's own voice and write and typing that we don't want to lose. But they make sure to add Airwood warnings where necessary, like if the person reports that they've been driving while they were high, then, you know, we add a little warning or you know, correct drug names and, you know, some very basic level of information correction.
But one of the very basic things that the triagers and reviewers are asked to do is to basically ask themselves while they're reading the report whether they think that this report is actually of the substance that the person reported taking and that it's not just a fake report. I mean, we get a very small number, but we do get there's a sort of, you know, fake submissions, and And then there's the reports that are some reports get submitted with email addresses, most don't. And if there's an email address and we have some additional questions, we sometimes email the author to ask them to partially just to if we have a question about a report and the person submits it with an email address and the person doesn't respond, that's a little bit of a mark against it in terms of the
Well, it's so invaluable. I mean, that kind of information that's based on, you know, people's like for me, when I'm trying to find something out, honestly, like I have this little trick where I go on chat groups. Like if I'm trying to dye my hair, let's say, because I'm a blonde now, but I used to be a redhead, which is a dangerous thing to do because you can make a mistake. So instead of reading like what the salon said, I went on the chat group because I want to see like what happened, like how did people mess up, like what did they do,
right.
Or like even whatever, like if you're a teenager and you're, you know, whatever, starting some kind of thing and you need information, like trying to find out, like, is it from a sponsor? Is it from the company making it? Is it from an enemy of the company making it? Like, or is it just someone who's, you know, a regular person having their experience of the thing? And I feel like that kind of information should be available for everything that you can, like a consumer reports kind of thing. But so that you guys are able to do that kind of discerning sort through it saves people like so much harrowing journeys and mistakes, and probably has contributed to saving people's lives. Like, have you guys ever heard any stories of readers that, you know, maybe went through your site and then were able to, you know, maybe solve some kind of life or death situation involving drug use or anything like that?
We hear people say generally to us quite often, you've saved my life. Specific stories, we have a few specific stories that people have told us. You know, some of them in relation to like somebody was on this particular drug, they were having a bad reaction, so they ended up being brought to the hospital, and the hospital people said you were doing what? Because they of course didn't recognize the name of the drug.
This is more late.
Oh God, that's so pathetic.
And so to be able to have to show the doctor a page that says the duration is this, this is the type of effects it has. Which changed the way the doctor treats it, because the doctor is like, well, oh, they're going to be unconscious. You know, like GHB is one of those situations. When GHB was really new, GHB sort of very short acting, but can cause unconsciousness, unconsciousness. Doctors, when they are faced with that, think, oh, they're going to be unconscious for 24 hours, and the fact is that they're going to pop awake after 3.5 hours, you know, so just very specific things like that. I wanted to go back a tiny bit. When you were talking, you reminded me, one of the issues that we face with experience reports specifically, and I think with all sorts of data about drugs, but when there's a brand new drug that we become aware of, like the first experience report, the first 5 experience reports that we get are some of the ones that we try to be most suspicious about, because if there's a brand new drug and there's a vendor who is selling it, if I were a vendor and I were trying to make money off of a new drug, I would send us a really positive experience report about it.
Totally.
You know, that would be what I would do. And so we sort of expect that is, in fact, what happens a lot. So we have always had a policy that we basically don't publish one experience report for a drug until we get 5 or 10. We just don't publish them. We wait until there's a range of them in order to sort of give multiple sides and multiples of the story.
For new drugs.
For brand new drugs. Yeah.
For Prozac or something.
Well, there's so, you know, there's so many ways to go in this conversation, and I do want to get to a discussion about what Arrowood Center is in contrast to the website. I'm also interested in hearing you guys reflect on this sort of explosion of new compounds. You're in a very unusual place to be able to sort of give us an overview of those things. But because I want to get to the Arrowood Center, which is something a lot of people probably don't know, they just think about the website, they go there, and it's really a remarkable thing that you're setting up, and there's some really great projects that you're involved in. So I just wanted to give you a little shot out here to sort of explain what it was and why you founded it, and maybe, you know, one or two of the things that you're doing with it that are most exciting you right now.
Okay, so we started the website in 1995, but we started it as a random hobby first, but then it was a business, but a sole proprietorship. So in 2008, we decided that what we we should do is change to the format of the organization into being a nonprofit. That's how we had basically been running it, and nonprofitable, we called it. we decided that we should form a nonprofit. So in 2008, we founded a nonprofit organization called Arrowwood Center. So it's an educational nonprofit. And that's the organization which runs Arrowwood.org, but we have a lot of other projects that we do also. So we have a newsletter. We run Ecstasy Data website. We do survey work. We do a variety of educational and help. We speak at conferences.
One of the most interesting ones I'd love to hear you talk about is the Wisdom Cycle project.
Right.
That seems to me a really exciting one.
Right. One of the bigger projects we're working on right now we call the Wisdom Cycle project, and it's a little bit of a goofy name. Most of our scientist friends have, told us to change the name or we're not participating. There will be other names for these those who can't accept that phrase, but. For us, one of the things that, going back to the standing there in college, being offered Adam and sort of, being expected to make a decision about taking some brand new drug before with a 19-year-old as my elder, was I really wanted to know what the people who first took psychedelics in the 1960s now thought about it, that many years later. And that generation of people who were young between, sort of in their kind of prime years of taking new drugs, which is 15 to 25 years, 5 years old for new drug experimenters primarily, that age group, that demographic, is now getting to be the seniors in our society. And what we think is really important is to try to survey them about their life experience, about whether they took psychedelics, cannabis, how they felt it affected them at the time, how they feel it affected their career, whether they have advice for young people who are faced with similar questions. Anyway,
it's one of the reasons we get so much contact from people who are in their drug experimenting years. So we hear a lot from people about what they think about LSD and that trip that they took last weekend. But what we don't hear enough of is what the people think about that one LSD trip they took when they were 15, now that they're 60. Did it matter? So would they go back and change that? Would they not take it? Would they have taken more? Do they regret it? Do they think they learned something from it? All of those questions. And it's a little bit hard to. One of the interesting things we're coming up against is trying to find those people. How do you find? We don't have that much access to 65 to 75 year olds who took LSD once when they were 15.
Right.
So we're working on trying to survey and learn from those people same sorts of things that we are recording contemporaneously from people.
One of the reasons I'm inspired by that project, beyond just being fascinated by the historical information, which you guys also do a lot of them. We've been talking mostly about current information and emerging drugs, but of course it's an incredible treasure trove of scan documents from the past and lots of things that you do in terms of developing a historical archive. But what I also like about it is it reflects the subtle way in which you guys are doing more than just providing better information or trying to improve the information environment, that there's also a hope and a dream and an ideal that we can evolve into a society, an individual on an individual level as well, very much, that just has a more rational but also a wiser approach to the psychoactives in our lives. And that's funny. I could see why the term wisdom would bother the scientists, but in a way it is kind of more like wisdom than rationality purely that we're talking about, which is that there are just better and worse ways of engaging these things and pretending that they're going to go away either in society or in one's individual life is probably pretty ridiculous for most people, but that there are all sorts of levels of how to engage them, how to move through the experiences, how to move away from the experiences, how to help other people, how to intervene in situations where there's a lot of misinformation or abuse. I mean, there's all these ranges of living with them in our lives, the way we live with all sorts of complicated problems. But because of prohibition, we haven't been given the tools from our parents, from the university. We have to make it up on our own. There's some really ingenious things about that, but it only goes so far, and there's a lot of problems as well. And that on a subtle but very deep level, you guys are actually creating that culture, or helping create that culture, creating the structure for that to go forward. Because the more that happens, the more we're able to take on what's coming down the pike. I mean, Earth referred to it earlier, and I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about it now as we kind of get to the end of the show, about what's coming down. That is, this isn't going away, and in fact, it's going to become more complicated, more hairy, as we have brain implants and direct brain stimulation that has a drug-like character. We have this explosion of new compounds, some of which are dangerous in very specific kinds of ways. And so that you're really helping to create the culture that can take that on now. And for that, I really just want to applaud you. But with our just the few minutes we have here, I would love to have you, especially Earth, to give just a little bit more on that, what's coming down the pike and why we need to be more mature and more well-informed and wiser about psychoactives in our lives.
Well, if we just exclude the crazy stuff that's going on in the pharmaceutical world, so let's not even talk about the kind of the legal development of new substances, the European the EMCDDA, which I can never quite remember, the European Monitoring or something.
European Monitoring Center for Drugs and Drug Addiction or Drug Abuse, I think.
Anyway, they're one of the best monitoring groups in the world, and they have a little bit too much tie to law enforcement to trust everything they say, but they're pretty good. They said 73 brand new, never before seen street drugs in 2012. And the last time I talked to somebody involved with that project, they said that we were on track to exceed that in 2013. So that's, you know, sort of 70, 80 new drugs each of the last 2 years. And just imagine trying to deal with that as an individual or as law enforcement or as a government. One of the evolutionary pressures that prohibition creates is towards more potent drugs, because the more doses you can fit into a smaller area and smuggle through things, the easier it is. I mean, if an individual in a small vial can carry 1,000 doses, that's totally different than if they can carry 10 doses.
You know, or a million.
Or a million. and so that's an odd pressure to have. It's not entirely obvious that's what is most beneficial to humans is to have unbelievably potent drugs, which, you know, you can start to qualify as neurotoxins at some, once they become super, super potent.
So one of the new drugs that has been, part of that 73, well, maybe it was actually 2010, not 2011, but are a series of drugs called the Enbomes, and the two most common of those are 25I and 25C Enbome. 25I is for short. 25I is about 10 times, it takes 10 times as much as acid for a single dose, but it still sits on blotter. And so one of the new things that's happening just sort of in the last year is that blotter that is found on the street now, you just can't assume that it's acid. I'm guessing. Here's my guess. My guess is that in the United States, blotter that people are buying at a festival, for example, is at least 30%, if not 50%, likely to be not LSD. So it's either one of the Enbomes, or there's a couple of other things that fit on blotter. I mean, 20 years ago, that just wasn't true. 20 years ago, it was either LSD or it was blank, right? You didn't get some other drug on your blotter. And so that's a big change that has happened recently. And there's a whole lot of that sort of change happening, that where once you get 10 drugs that are sort of euphoric stimulants, kind of like MDMA, that are white powders, well, now white powder can be not just one thing, not just three things, not just 10 things. It can be one of 100 things, and even an experienced person taking one of those things wouldn't necessarily be able to identify whether it was MDMA or whether it was one of 10 other things. So it's definitely a hairy world of new drugs.
Particularly because of some of these dosage issues, the pressure on making a more and more powerful compound means that some end users wind up with a compound that they think is something and it's something else, and they take way too much of it. And so it's this paradoxical loop that in essence is all derived from prohibition, from like, gee, if you could just get LSD, then, you know, there probably wouldn't be too much interest in a lot of these things. So, and this is just the kind of, in a way, like you say, that's sort of the tip of the iceberg. There's no reason to expect the cycle to change anytime soon. So it's sort of like a race almost to get information into people, which did lead me to one. We just have a couple minutes left. I know that there's been discussion around having Arrowhead information be available on mobile apps. Is that something that you guys have done? Are you working on it? Because especially from the harm reduction point of view, it would seem like you really want that. So is that one of the things that you guys are working on?
Yes, absolutely. We've had, a lot of our work gets done by volunteers, and we've had a couple of volunteers work on it, and one of the problems with working with volunteers is that it isn't that when something else happens in their life, their volunteer work is often the thing that gets put aside. So we've got a start on making Arrowhead mobile friendly, and that's definitely high on our priority list.
Well, I just want to cut in on that just to sort of reemphasize that. You know, you guys are in a fundraising month. You do this every September. A lot of your contributions that you're able to keep going come from, ordinary people don't have a lot of money, giving very small donations, but in mass it really makes a big difference. And there's a lot of really good work you guys could do with more funding, and there's no, you're not getting the government money, you're not getting the fancy scientific research thing, because what you do is still... it's still a little bit too controversial. It's a weird world you're in.
Yep. So we have our September drop going right now, and we would love to have people go to the front page of Arrowhead and show their support with just a small donation if they find it useful.
Great. Well, we're going to have to end it there. So, Earth and Fire, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you so much.
All righty, folks, go check out Arrowhead.org. Until next week, keep your minds open.